From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The new TV season is beginning, but we start today's Fresh Air with someone responsible for some of the greatest comedy of TV's past. Carl Reiner wrote for and performed on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, and he created The Dick Van Dyke Show. Well, that doesn't mean we're going to overlook the new TV season. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of two new series. Also today, pianist Richard Good tells us why the most popular of Beethoven's piano sonatas are sometimes also the hardest to play. He's in the middle of recording all of them. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from guitarist John Scofield. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush said today there is no contemplation of combat roles for U.S. servicemen sent to Latin America to help in the fight against illegal drugs. Bush made the declaration after White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater complained there are a lot of people who are trying to portray this as another Vietnam. At the Capitol, meanwhile, Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Robert Byrd said he will introduce legislation that will increase next year's anti-drug spending by nearly $4 billion, paying for it by cutting domestic and defense programs across the board. The Food and Drug Administration says it has found manufacturing and record-keeping problems at 10 of the 12 generic drug manufacturers it has investigated so far. That causes some concern on Capitol Hill, as Michael Richards reports.
The FDA has relied on a kind of honor system to keep tabs on generic drugs, those cut-rate medicines that are supposed to do the same thing as brand-name products. But at a hearing of a House investigative subcommittee today, members of both parties said that the honor system appears to be flawed. The FDA has stepped up its supervision of the industry, although three FDA officials are accused of taking bribes from generic drug makers. As a result of its investigations, so far the FDA has recommended prosecution of three companies for their generic drug practices. Only one has been named publicly. The FDA says its investigation is continuing, and a more complete picture of the generic drug business will be available in a few months. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
Leftist guerrillas in El Salvador have announced a 10-day unilateral truce. The proposed truce would coincide with peace talks in Mexico this week. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
A rebel communique issued this morning says the ceasefire will start Wednesday. The rebels are due to hold talks for the first time with the newly elected rightist government of President Alfredo Cristiani on Wednesday and Thursday in Mexico. The rebels say they want to put negotiation of a more permanent ceasefire at the top of the agenda. Cristiani also says a ceasefire is necessary to create the right atmosphere for dialogue. So far, there's been no official government reaction, however, to today's rebel communique. But Armed Forces Chief Colonel René Emilio Ponce said the initiative was merely designed to gain the rebels' points abroad. The rebels, in turn, have accused Cristiani of placing obstacles by opposing the presence of observers in the talks. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Thousands of East Germans streamed across Hungary's newly opened border today to start new lives in the West as an angry East Berlin lashed out at Bonn and Budapest for lifting the Iron Curtain. Thousands more may be en route to West Germany. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 5 points to close at 2704.41. Declines led advances 9-5 on volume of 126 million shares. This is NPR News. Smoke from a huge pile of burning used tires rose 1,000 feet into the air today in Danville, New Hampshire, and was visible 25 miles away. Margaret Landsman Weiner of member station WEVO reports that firefighters dumped tons of dirt to smother the flames.
Gravel is being dumped today on part of a 7-acre mound of tires that burned through the night. It's the second time in 5 years a major blaze has ripped through the pile of an estimated 1 million tires near the town of Danville. State Fire Marshal Bill Toland says water had little effect on flames that leapt 40 feet high.
They were pouring 2,500 gallons a minute from different locations and it didn't even put a dent in it.
35 people were evacuated because of possible exposure to carbon monoxide from smoke. EPA officials say they're worried about the potential for groundwater contamination. The latest fire is old news to area residents who have lived by the illegal dump for almost two decades. A state plan to chip and recycle the tires was slated to begin this month. Officials believe cost of the cleanup could be as much as $1 million. For National Public Radio, I'm Margaret Lansman-Weiner in Danville, New Hampshire.
A review of Navy documents in the USS Iowa investigation showed today there is no evidence a detonator existed, and the report raises questions about the official conclusion that a gunner's mate probably sparked the huge explosion aboard the ship to kill himself. The Navy announced Thursday its investigators had ruled out accidental detonation as the cause of the explosion and said Petty Officer Clayton Hartwig probably set off the blast intentionally. But according to a UPI review, the documents subsequently studied in the Navy's 1,100-page report raise more questions than answers. A California real estate agent testified today that PTL founder Jim Baker sold a luxury home a month he resigned from the television ministry, and he lost at least $85,000. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Carl Reiner got his start on TV in 1950, playing second banana to one of TV's first big stars, Sid Caesar. Reiner also wrote for Caesar's weekly hit variety series, Your Show of Shows. These behind-the-scenes experiences inspired Reiner to create the now classic sitcom, The Dick Van Dyke Show. It starred Dick Van Dyke as a writer for a variety show whose host was played by Reiner himself. Then Reiner left the small screen for the big screen. He acted in such films as The Russians Are Coming and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. He directed the movie Enter Laughing, based on his semi-autobiographical novel, then went on to direct Oh God, Where's Papa, as well as the Steve Martin films The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me. Reiner's latest movie, Burt Rigby, You're a Fool, is now out on home video. The movie is about someone whose fantasy life is totally absorbed in classic Hollywood musicals. I asked Carl Reiner if that was true of him.
Well, it's still true of me. I mean, I will turn around if I'm going out the door and I hear a Gene Kelly or a Fred Astaire number or any of the old musicals, I'll turn around and watch it on TV if that's where it is. And I do have a lot of tapes of those shows. I just, when I feel depressed, I throw them on and my wife and I just hum along with them.
Did you ever wish you were the kind of guy who could break out into song at the appropriate moment in real life?
I am that kind of guy. Terry Gross, you're one of the most. No, I sing and dance all the time, and I just can't stop it. In the car, I'm singing a little off key, but always singing.
This is a movie about trying to break into to movies and to the stage. Was it hard for you to break in, and did anybody, your parents even, tell you that you were a fool when you were trying?
Oh, no. My parents were very proud of the fact that I wouldn't be a bum and I wanted to be an actor. See, they thought, they revered actors because when I was a kid, you see, I, being of Jewish heritage, when you have an image of the actor, it was Edward G. Robinson, Paul Mooney, and then when they found out that Basil Rathbone was Jewish, they said, you're going into a good business. A lot of Jewish people go in that business. And they were very happy I became an actor. They just wanted me to be an actor in my neighborhood. They didn't want me to go away. And so when I did radio in New York and some plays in New York when I was very young, they were very happy. Then when I went to Summer Theater when I was 18, they were pretty upset. They said, you're going away to act? Why can't you act here? That was the only objection they ever had, though.
You started in serious roles in the theater, didn't you? How did you get into comedy?
Well, the Army will happen. No, actually, I got into comedy because my first year that I didn't do serious stuff, I had done a Shakespearean tour. I'd been in summer theaters doing about 36 plays before I got to do my first musical variety review. And that was in a summer, a summer situation where I was a straight man actor in sketches. And I really took the sketches very well because I had a background of theater, so I played them real, but I was basically a silly person, so I was able to find the fun in it. And then in the Army, you couldn't ask people to mount a play for you, so I got up in front of a microphone and started doing stand-up material, and I really became a comedian in the Army. It's a good place to become a comedian. If you keep your sense of humor there, you'll stay a little saner than most.
So you were a comedian, but did you ever play, for instance, the Borscht Belt as a stand-up?
I started to. I went the first year back out of the Army, I started to do that, and I was an MC up at a Borscht Belt place. Actually, it was out of the Borscht Belt, but it was Borscht Belt kind of stuff, and it was in Keene, New Hampshire. And right from then, I had auditioned for that job in the Borscht Belt, but somebody looked into the room, a little glass window, and they saw me performing. And this was Herman Levin, who had done a big Broadway show called Call Me Mister, and he invited me to do the road company, remembered me from the audition. He actually bootlegged my audition. He looked through a window and saw enough. I don't know how he knew it, but I went and did the lead on a road company of Call Me Mister. And then I did a lot of musicals after that, Inside USA with B. Lilly and Jack Haley, and then into Your Show of Shows, which was, again, review comedy. But it all started in the Army.
You did Your Show of Shows. You were one of the stars of it. You were one of the writers on it. And it really turned into one of the most important shows in the history of television. Did you have any sense?
Well, it was the first of its kind, and I think that makes it important.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first of its kind, and luckily it was excellent. I mean, the first of its kind sometimes isn't revered. It's just that you break some ground. But this was the first of its kind, and it was peopled by extraordinary writing and performing talent. Max Liebman had a great eye for selecting people that might be stars someday. And he found Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. Before that, he had worked with Danny Kaye, so he really had a good eye.
How did he find you?
He found me in a Broadway show. I was performing in a Broadway show, and the first full year of Your Show of Shows was about to go on the air, and he needed somebody to support Sid Caesar. And I had been a first banana up until that time. I had been a leading comedian, and he invited me to become the second banana. When I had seen Sid in Tars and Spars and another venture on Broadway, me and Make My Manhattan, and I thought this guy was an extraordinary talent, and being a second banana to such a massive first banana wasn't a come down at all for me. I realized I was working with the best.
So being second banana to Sid Caesar, did he want to get all? Was he the kind of performer who wanted all the good lines for himself? Was he
a hog in any way? No, as
a
matter of fact, he was very good about the piece being right. And if you got a laugh, and if you did something funny, he would never say, "Oh, let me do that." He just lets you do it. As a matter of fact, Sid was the best double talker in the whole world. He'd double talk French, Spanish, German, Chinese, Japanese, what have you. And I also was pretty good at double talk, and I knew I would never get to do my double talk impressions. And so I came up with the idea of doing foreign movies. In the third week of the Show of Shows that was on the air, and it was such a success. As a matter of fact, that's the way I became a writer without portfolio. Up to that time, I'd been just an actor. And now I was just an actor, but who had some ideas. So I was always in the writer's room from then on. We never got credit in those days for writing. Actors were actors and writers were writers. But I did learn my craft working with those brilliant writers.
So you started hanging out with the writers and sitting in on all the writing meetings and contributing ideas.
Oh, it started in the third week, and it was 9 years of that. And I became actually a writer without portfolio. I considered myself a writer at that point because I worked on things that even was not going to be in. I worked on some of his monologues, and Mel Brooks and I did a lot of work on and Sid did on The Professor, where I asked him questions, which was actually the genesis of my asking Mel Brooks about the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, yeah.
That's another second banana roll that I relish.
In the writers' meetings for the Sid Caesar show?
Yes.
Was there ever an air of complete desperation where you had this whole room of really funny people, but they were just on the verge of killing themselves because they weren't coming up with what they wanted to?
Oh, I tell you, you're reminding me now of a moment when, after we'd been on about 2 or 3 years, and we had done 5 sketches a week for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that was an hour and a half show, and one day, on a Monday, we came in, and we sat around trying to fill some of the forms, and everybody came up blank. Everybody had dried up at the same time, and we all decided that was it. We said to Max Liebman, then we said, "We're going to come on the air and just sit there, the four of us, Sid Caesar, Imogene Coca, myself, and Howard Morris, and just stare at the set, and then we'd go blank, and somebody would come and say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, there is no more comedy. We have done all we can. No more. This is it. Good night.' And we were going to do that. And we laughed about that. As a matter of fact, we decided to try a sketch where we started a sketch, like a vice president, people being ushered into a room, into a salon where they were going to obviously perform a sketch. One by one, they say, 'Lord Trixton, General so-and-so,' they come in, and they sit down on a couch and just sit there without doing anything. And we showed it to Max. We said, 'This is the sketch.' We just sat there, And he said, what is that? What is that? We sat for 5 minutes. And of course, everybody broke up. They said, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there. We said, that's it, Max. There's no more comedy. We couldn't come up with an idea. So we think we'd like to do that. America will tune in and say, they're just sitting there. They haven't moved in 5 minutes. One guy crossed his leg, and that was it. We were that desperate at that point. Of course, that week we probably came up with the best show we ever did.
There were several of the writers on the program were Jewish. You, Mel Brooks, toward the end of the
Mel run. Brooks is Jewish?
That's a shock. Woody Allen worked on the show toward its end, and who knows who else I'm not mentioning here. But I was wondering if you were allowed to do Jewish characterizations, to have Yiddish words or to use a Jewish accent on the show.
I don't think we ever used a Jewish accent. I didn't know. After the war and during the war and before the war, it became, people decided that making fun of any ethnic group was not good for people who were being slaughtered by somebody who thought they weren't worthy of living. So we did use a lot of Yiddish words, and especially in our Japanese movies, we did. I remember some of the names. Shtaka Yamagura. Shtaka meaning strong, but it had a Japanese sound to it. Baron Kashimoto. Kasha is a word, as a food. But we always, anytime we used the Jewish word, we didn't allow that to lay out there alone. We always had another joke that everybody who didn't understand the word would be watching at the same time that joke was happening. We were very responsible to our audience not to do inside jokes that only some people would get.
I bet there were a lot of Yiddish-type sketch ideas that you came up with behind the scenes that you ended up tossing out since it wasn't appropriate for TV.
Well, as a matter of fact, the 2,000-year-old man was in the office with us every day, and every time we got bored, I turned to Mel and I interviewed the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, really?
Who basically was of the Hebrew persuasion. So we had that.
How did you come up with the idea for the 2,000-year-old man? What was the story behind that?
Well, it was a very simple story. I came in one morning, having seen something irresponsible on television, and somebody who actually claimed to have been someplace they couldn't have been, and I said, oh, that's a ridiculous thing. I don't know why they put that on the air. And in anger, I said to Mel, I understand you were actually at the scene of the crucifixion, sir. He said, oh, boy. And then started a 10-year interview that I did every time we got bored in the office. I'd turn to Mel and question about all the people he knew, having lived 2,000 years from Jesus Christ on to the present day.
Now, how did that end up being recorded and being done on television?
Well, we had done it for years at parties. We were always invited to parties, sort of like command performances, and we didn't feel we wanted to do that. We figured we had enough stature to be just invited to eat and talk, but I always brought a tape recorder with me, and I felt that I loved hearing Mel do this, and I wanted to have a record of it. So I had about 10 years of, maybe 10 years of this stuff before we got into a situation where Joe Fields, who was a big writer-producer on Broadway, he used to love it. And every time he'd have a party, invite Mel and I to do it. And he did it on the coast once, the West Coast. And every major star was there. And George Burns came up to us and said, you better put it on record or I'm going to steal it. Eddie G. Robinson came up. He says, make a Broadway play out of it. I want to play that man. And Steve Allen came up and said, why don't you put it on record? And we said, no. He says, why don't you let me pay for the tape? I have a little record company. If you don't like it, you can tear it, burn it, expunge it, whatever you want. And we did it. We did it in front of a crowd of 200 people, this whole ad-lib tape for 2 hours. We cut it down to 47 minutes, and it worked. And then we did 4 more albums after that.
Did you ever break yourselves up through an improvisation that you didn't expect?
Oh, all the time, because this was all ad-lib. The 4 albums we did were never prepared. We just went with an audience and just sat and chatted for 2 hours usually, and took the best of it. No, I was always off mic giggling and stuffing handkerchiefs into my mouth, and sometimes not hearing because I was laughing. I didn't even hear what the second part was until I heard it back on the tape and then laughed again.
Yeah. My guest is Carl Reiner, film director, writer, actor. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Carl Reiner is my guest, and he co-starred in and was one of the writers for Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show, and his movies include Oh God, Where's Papa? And several films that starred Steve Martin, including The Jerk, All of Me, and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Let me ask you a little bit about the Dick Van Dyke Show. I've always assumed that the show was based on your experiences writing for and performing in Your Show of Shows.
Did you come to that on your own, or did you read it someplace?
Because it's obvious.
No, but it was. Yeah, it was based on my life as a writer actor on the Show of Shows, and it was my home life fantasized and satirized and lied about. No, but basically, it was the husband and wife on the Dick Van Dyke Show was my wife and myself. I mean, that's all I knew. I knew no other marriage intimately. We've been married 45 years, and at that time was about 20 or 30 years.
Does that mean that when you came home every night, you said, "Hi, honey, I'm home"?
No, because usually the kids heard me first, and there's a car coming in the driveway, a dog barking, a big dog. She knew I was home when I came home. I never said hi. As a matter of fact, "Hi, honey, I'm home" was probably hardly ever said. I think maybe I used it once, because that was a cliche of all situation comedies, and I rarely used that. I mean, he probably said it one or two times, but most of the time we started with the script. If he said, "Hi, honey, I'm home," it was for a reason, not just to start a script.
Did you ever trip over the divan on your way into the living room?
I'm a klutz. My wife, I didn't do that, but I don't know how many thousands of times I stepped onto the back of her scuffs while she was walking, and I was walking behind her and had her trip forward. I think most men are klutzy in some areas. I mean, except for maybe Baryshnikov. I think Baryshnikov and Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire and Cary Grant never trip.
On the Dick Van Dyke Show, it always seemed like Dick Van Dyke saw himself as the sane person in the middle of all these really crazy people. Did you ever feel that way?
I always felt that way. I am basically always the sane person in a madhouse. Starting in the very, very first show on Broadway called Call Me Mister, I remember the producer saying, when I went on the road, he said, "Now, I don't ever want you to ask me for a raise, because you're supposed to get great reviews. If you don't get great reviews, you don't deserve to be in this play, so don't send me great reviews and say you want a raise after you leave New York." And I never did, but when I got to Chicago, they had the reviewer had seen it in New York a few months before and said, "I'm not going to like this company any better than I like the one in New York," and then proceeded to write a glowing review of me, saying that I changed the show from what she didn't like to what she did like. And I said, "Boy, what a time to ask for a raise," and I knew I couldn't. However, I had a bunch of nuts in the company. They would tear phones out of the wall. They fought with each other. They kept coming to my dressing room and say, "Can I dress with you?" I had the star dressing room downstairs. "I can't dress with so-and-so." A real bunch of nuts. And if I told you their names, you'd say, "Oh, yes, you're probably right." Well, I wrote to the producer and said, "I'm not sending you the reviews, but I do believe I deserve a raise just for being the company psychiatrist. This company will fall apart if I weren't there to minister to it." And you know, he sent me a $35 raise.
Hey.
I got a $35 raise for being a company psychiatrist. So I really have I'm supposed to be the sane one in every situation. I really am not, but I certainly know how to play it.
The Dick Van Dyke Show has become one of the really classic sitcoms from television. Was it nevertheless a difficult show to sell to the network after you had created it?
No, as a matter of fact, the network bought it right away. They knew the quality of the show, and they knew the performances were very winning. Our ratings the first year weren't the best because we were on opposite Perry Como, who was riding real high at the time, had a wonderful show, a variety show. And they were thinking of canceling us the second year because we were only half sponsored. But Sheldon Leonard, our executive producer, got the other half sponsored. And I voted for a very sort of dramatic thing that was not being done at the time, to rerun it during the summer. I said, "People who didn't see us can sample us now. People who watched Perry Como can sample us." And it happened. They sampled us and they stayed with us the following year and for the next 5 years.
How did you cast yourself as Alan Brady, the star of the show?
Why did I cast myself doing it originally?
Yeah, how did you cast yourself doing it? Yeah.
Oh, you mean Alan Brady? Well, I was looking for a major star, and I knew I couldn't get a major star to play a major star by and giving him so many small scenes to do. So I said, I got to find somebody who they would think it was a star. And then I cast myself. I said, well, I was a second banana, but I was close to being a star. And the first year, I didn't turn around. I used the back of my head. I used myself on a phone or under a towel when I was being shaved or something. And I didn't show my face because I didn't want the audience to say, oh, is that the star? He's not big enough. But by the second and third year, the scripts got so elaborate. And they seemed to like Alan Brady that I turned him around and showed who he was, and it turned out to be me, and nobody was terribly disappointed, so we stayed with it.
My guest is film director, TV writer, actor, and producer Carl Reiner. Why did you end up switching to films after working in television?
Well, I had done 15 years of television, almost weekly for 15 years, and the bigger the screen, the bigger the challenge. And I grew up watching movies, and I knew someday, I wanted someday to be on that screen. Actually, I got on the screen as an actor before I started directing in a few pictures, but the best of them being The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. At least I had a starring role in that. But right after that, I directed my first movie, Enter Laughing, and that was the most exciting thing of all.
You directed Steve Martin in All of Me, and that's the movie in which his body is supposed to be invaded by the spirit of the soul of Lily Tomlin.
Right.
And so he has to act as if his body is the shell for her.
Right.
How did you work with him on getting the gestures and movements on that? It was such a good performance.
Well, it was he worked very hard at home alone, having this human person inside of him, a female person. And it's funny, Steve Martin is another one of those graceful, ungraceful men. He has very big hands and big feet, and there's no way he doesn't have the ballet hands. And that's the only thing he missed. As a matter of fact, that's one of the few things I instructed him in, how the hand might be a little more graceful. But other than that, he came in one day and showed me a scene when the first time Lily Tomlin's soul gets into his body, where he was trying to walk like a man and the woman's sensibilities and soul would take over. And this schizoid personality, when he showed it to me, it was just brilliant. He had come in and worked in the house with this walk and this half-man, half-woman approach. It was brilliant. And we just refined it and honed it, but it was there. It was very difficult to keep straight, by the way, to know when the man was in charge when the woman was in charge.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your son, Rob Reiner. He first became an acting star in All in the Family as Meathead, and then he became a director, directing movies like Princess Bride, Spinal Tap, Stand By Me. Did you ever expect him to go into show business?
Not when he was very young, although he had a tremendous ability to remember everything he'd ever seen. I mean, he's one of these kids who absorbs... He was one of those kids who absorbed everything he saw on television and movies. But he never stated it loudly that he was going to do it. But in his heart, he wanted to be a director always. Isn't that amazing? And he only told us about it later. When he was about 19 years old, I saw him direct a... Ricky Dreyfuss and he were friends when they were in high school. And he directed a version of No Exit by Sartre. And it was brilliant. He was only about 18 or 19 at the time. At that point, his road was starting to be paved. He wanted to be a director, and there was no question that he knew that. And he wasn't telling it to everybody because, you know, when you're young and say, I want to be a director, they say, I get out of here. And he had it in his mind, I'm sure, all the time he was on All in the Family. He was planning it.
One last thing. Does writing comedy help make life any more enjoyable? Do things, can you put a comic spin on things in real life?
Oh, yes, because writing comedy and writing it successfully, having your pictures made and people laugh at it, you know what happens? They give you money for that.
Right.
And you take that money, you buy a house, you buy a nice car, get good clothes, good food. Of course, when you get older, you can't eat the really good food. You got to eat the simpler food. But it does make life very pleasant.
Carl Reiner's latest film, Bert Rigby, You're a Fool, is now out on home video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, from jocks to nerds, fashion expert Richard Martin talks with us about what the clothes say about the man. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Five years ago, pianist Richard Good began a daunting project, recording all 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. Coming up, Richard Good talks about playing with his heart on his sleeve. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Flat Out, the new album from John Scofield, a guitarist equally at home with jazz and rock. And television critic David Bianculli takes a first look at two new shows on ABC. Chicken Soup is a sitcom starring veteran comic Jackie Mason. And Life Goes On follows a family with a teenager who has Down syndrome. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President George Bush emphasized today that his administration is not considering any expansion of the role of the U.S. military in fighting drug cartels in South America. Jim Angle reports from the White House.
The White House went to great lengths today to let everyone know it has no plans to put U.S. military personnel into combat situations against South American drug traffickers. President Bush spoke to the issue at an anniversary ceremony for the Treasury Department.
And there is no contemplation of the U.S. of the use of American armed forces in any combat role there. No U.S. military personnel will accompany host government forces on actual field operations.
By field operations, the president means missions aimed at drug trafficking facilities such as cocaine labs, which can be heavily armed. The president would allow troops to go on some patrols, but only if they're intended for training. The National Security Directive, said one official, is very clear on that point. It says training, not combat with drug lords, is why American forces are there. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
The American Bar Association is calling on President Bush to end the export of U.S.-made assault-style weapons to Colombia, saying that such a ban would not violate the Constitution. Recently, Drug Policy Director William Bennett had said that banning the manufacture of assault-style weapons might not be constitutional. According to West German officials, more than 6,000 East German refugees traveled from Hungary to West Germany at the start of what could be the exodus of tens of thousands. Deidre Berger has more on the story.
Since the Hungarian government decided yesterday to suspend a treaty with East Germany, most of the 7,000 East German refugees who were living in Red Cross camps in Hungary have departed for the West. The first contingent arrived late last night and early this morning in their own cars. The Austrian government sent about 75 buses to Hungary to transport the remaining refugees, who started arriving at West German border camps this evening. West German officials said they are prepared in case tens of thousands of East Germans use the opportunity in the next week to come to West Germany through Hungary. The East German government today sharply attacked Hungary for breaking its bilateral treaty with East Germany forbidding departures to a third country. Romania, Czechoslovakia, and Bulgaria also condemned Hungary's decision to release the refugees. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Passau, West Germany.
The FAA plans to order structural modifications to ensure the safety of over 1,100 older McDonnell Douglas DC-10s, DC-9s, DC-8s, and MD-80 jetliners flown by U.S. Airlines. A government industry task force has recommended that work be done to increase the safety of the 1,900 McDonnell Douglas airliners in service throughout the world. Light trading on Wall Street as the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 5 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Electric guitarist John Scofield has recorded with a wide variety of musicians, Charles Mingus, Jay McShann, and Chet Baker. But Scofield may be best known for his own albums and a stint in the early 80s with Miles Davis. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Scofield's new album. Kevin says Scofield is that rare musician who can mix jazz and rock without shortchanging either.
When I was a kid who knew nothing, one reason I thought jazz was for squares was the sound jazz guitar players got. I'd been listening to guys like Jimi Hendrix, who could howl and sustain notes like a raucous saxophone player. Jazz guitarists had these muffled tones that made them sound like they were stuck in a closet. Even after I got older and learned about the jazz and blues guitarists who'd helped inspire rock, I still kept wishing jazz guitarists would pick up on the rude sounds that rockers were using. Next time, I'll be more careful what I wish for. In the wake of John McLaughlin came a zillion shrill fusion guitarists, who are great at running scales, but not so good at making music. But there are some good, loud jazz guitar players, like John Scofield. Scofield combines a jazz musician's solid knowledge of harmony with a rocker's brittle tone. A decade ago, he was making straight jazz records. Then he joined Miles Davis's electric band and began rocking out. Nowadays, he strikes a balance between the two. His new record, Flat Out, on the Gramavision label, features the rhythm section he's been touring with, drummer Johnny Vidakovich and bassist Anthony Cox. Cox is a great bassist for improvising around riffs, because he's never content to just pound out a repeating pattern. He always works variations on a theme. Vidakovich, who's from New Orleans, plays those snappy parade rhythms that nearly every drummer from that city has a weakness for. He shows off his hometown stuff on a cover of Sissy Strut by the old New Orleans R&B group The Meters. The organ player is Don Grolnick. Of other New Orleans-styled numbers on Scofield's new album, including Huey Piano Smith's Rockin' Pneumonia. But Scofield also does a couple of jazz standards. He gives a Caribbean lilt to the old Doris Day favorite, Secret Love. Scofield also plays Jerome Kern's jam session warhorse, All the Things You Are. I especially like the way he takes Dizzy Gillespie's little descending phrase, which begins and ends almost every jazz version of the tune, and constructs a long closing episode around it. This is one of three tracks where Terry Lynn Carrington is on drums. Thank you. main reason this jazz partisan likes Schofield's Rocky playing is that it's so well grounded in the feel of jazz and blues. He doesn't just toss off a few of the right licks. That's what makes him more than just some flash I would pan.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed John Schofield's Flat Out on Grammavision. This is Fresh Air. Every young piano student learns Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. Richard Good was no exception, but the real challenge was giving it a fresh interpretation as an adult. 5 years ago, the Book of the Month Club approached him to record the complete cycle of Beethoven's sonatas. Volumes 1 and 2 have been released, and now Good is currently finishing the cycle for Nonesuch Records. Good studied piano with Rudolf Serkin and was a founding member of the Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society. Good's album of Brahms piano and clarinet sonatas with Richard Stoltzman won a Grammy in 1983. I asked Good how he reacted when he was first approached to record the Beethoven sonata cycle.
I had not played all the Beethoven sonatas, and I hesitated a little bit, perhaps 10 seconds, before I said yes. And that was about 5 years ago.
There have been several pianists who have recorded the complete cycle of sonatas before. Did you ever ask yourself, do we need another volume of the complete sonatas?
Well, of course, you ask yourself things like that. But in the end, you do what you do anyway, in the hope that, in the hope that you'll play them well enough to justify yet another complete set. There have been very many, that's true. There were a couple of Beethoven sonatas that I have a little difficulty with. Even so, strangely enough, the famous ones, the Apollon and the Waldstein, the most famous, were the two that I had the hardest time, perhaps because of over-familiarity, because maybe they had assumed a sort of symbolic significance in my mind.
If the Appassionata is an example of a sonata that you had difficulty with, what's an example of one that you really enjoy playing very much and that you feel very close to?
Many, but I would say any of the late sonatas that I always felt close to, or many others.
Ask you what I realize is probably a foolish question. When you're recording in the studio, do you have music on the piano?
Occasionally, mostly not.
So that means that you've really memorized all the sonatas that you're playing.
Well, I have usually for performance anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have, I don't know, I know this will sound really naive, but I'm not a performer. I don't really trust my memory, and I find it really astounding to really be able to remember that much, and I wonder what the memory process is like for you, if you just, by playing it a lot, have it memorized, or if it's something you have to systematize and work at.
Combination. Mostly if you play it a lot, I think it usually comes by memory. It varies also because most of the music I play, which is 18th and 19th century music, is written in harmonic style that I'm familiar with. And after a while can sort of play it by ear. And the patterns are familiar and so forth. If I play 20th century music, it's much harder to memorize. If I play Bach, it's also very difficult. I think this is actually a thorn in many pianists' side, only we don't talk about it that much, the idea of having to play without music. I think that pianists would have larger repertoires if they did that.
So you would occasionally like to have the music with you on the piano.
But yeah, I have done that.
Uh-huh.
I have done that. And actually, you have to get used to that, too. You have to get used to having the kind of freedom that you would if you played by heart. There is something about not having anything in front of you and being completely visually and physically free. But after all, people play chamber music with the music all the time, and nobody complains, so why not?
You play on contemporary pianos, right? I mean, do you think it's important to play Beethoven on authentic instruments, on the instruments of the period?
So far, I would say no. So far, I think it could be very revealing, but I feel, after all is said and done, piano in Beethoven's day was not yet completely satisfying voice. And I still think, from listening to reconstructions of Beethoven instruments at the time, that it's not sufficient, that the treble is still not eloquent, not singing enough, and that it doesn't fulfill what I hear as the requirements for the music, particularly the later music. There are many wonderful things, but I still feel on balance that the modern instrument is capable of doing almost all of those things, and the old instrument is not capable of doing some of the marvelous things that the modern piano can.
How did you start studying piano?
I was intended to study the violin. I actually started singing. I was imitating various pop singers on the radio, and my parents thought that was nice. Maybe I should do something about that. So my father had played the violin for a couple of years, although my family are not musicians. He thought that would be a logical instrument. And so a piano was the first stepping stone to playing the violin, but I never got beyond the piano. I liked it. It was sufficient.
You said that when your parents wanted to get you an instrument, it was because you had been singing along with pop records on the radio. What got you directed more toward classical music than pop?
You know, I've never thought of that. You mean I could have done something completely different?
I don't know. You could have been a pop star.
I don't know. I never thought of that. I actually still like some pop music, though not rock. But it became secondary very, very early on.
I think of you, and I don't know if you think this is accurate or not, but I think of you as a somewhat restrained player. And as someone who's probably trying to always avoid what might be perceived as cheap sentiment in music.
I think of myself as a hard-on-sleeve player who never tries to avoid cheap sentiment in music.
Really? Okay.
But I play music which doesn't have, for the most part, cheap sentiment in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's interesting.
No, what makes you think of yourself as a hard-on-sleeve player?
Because that's the way I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's what I love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to me that music is basically, it's everything but an emotional expression above all. And what I would like to be able to do is be as direct and open and intense as possible emotionally when I play. I have to admit that when I studied with Serkin,
yeah,
I had a fantasy, which would never fulfilled, which was that I would play a piece, you know, and uh-huh, I would be inspired that particular week, and I would play a piece, and there would be a silence, at the end. And I would turn around to find him sobbing helplessly in the corner. it never happened.
Oh, that's great. When you're done with a record and the record is released, do you listen back to it then?
No. I listen to it before it's released. And then I almost never listen to it again.
Why not?
I think in terms of usually if I do listen to it, I will hear things that I'd rather do differently, and then I'd rather not know about it. And I think that's also, I don't know if it's with me specifically or with most performers, is that you do think in terms of the next performance and not the one that you gave. And although it's probably an illusion, you always think that your next performance is going to be the better one. And that's the performance that you care about.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pianist Richard Good, his next album in the cycle of the complete Beethoven sonatas is Opus 31, numbers 1, 2, and 3, due out next month on Nonesuch Records. Last spring, he released a recording of the late sonatas. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Tonight on All Things Considered, East German refugees fleeing to the West from Hungary. We're going to look at this story from several directions, including the effect this is having on the relations between Hungary and its neighbors in the Eastern Bloc. We'll look at the president's policy of sending troops to the Andean nations to help in the war on drugs. And we have a long and thoughtful piece from Tom Jelton in Colombia on the paramilitary organizations maintained by drug traffickers. In addition to sending drugs to this country, they fight the guerrillas, the left-wing guerrillas in that country. There are primaries in Detroit and in New York. We'll take a look at how those things are expected to come out later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Six new TV series are airing sneak previews this week. TV critic David Bianculli says you can see the two most unusual of the bunch Tuesday night on ABC. Chicken Soup stars stand-up comic Jackie Mason, and Life Goes On features a young actor who has Down syndrome. David has this review.
Chicken Soup is going to be a hit. It's by the executive producers of Roseanne and The Cosby Show, and it follows Roseanne on the ABC schedule. On the other hand, Life Goes On is a long shot. After two preview showings this week, it moves opposite the popular 60 Minutes on Sundays, where it'll have trouble attracting an audience. And that's a shame, because based on the pilot episodes, Life Goes On deserves to be a hit, and Chicken Soup doesn't. In Chicken Soup, Jackie Mason is a 52-year-old Jewish man whose mother has just moved in with him. Lynn Redgrave plays Mary, his Catholic next-door neighbor. Rita Karen plays his mother.
That Mary, such a lovely girl. No, if you were a Gentile, I tell you to date her?
If I was a Gentile, I wouldn't have to listen to you.
Well, the situation in this situation comedy is that Jackie and Mary are in love. And midway through the pilot episode, he finally tells his mother the truth.
Me and Maddie. We're gonna be a couple.
Why couldn't you be gay like everyone else?
You didn't laugh? Neither did I. Chicken Soup is a Bridget Loves Bernie for the 90s, with Mason doing monologues to open and close each show, the way George Burns and Jack Benny used to do it. The key difference, though, is that Burns and Benny were a riot. Mason doesn't even rank as a civil disturbance. Then there's Life Goes On, which sounds sappy but isn't. Patti LuPone and Bill Smitrovich play the parents of three kids. One of them, Corky, has Down syndrome. But they all daydream and worry and argue like normal kids. Here they are at breakfast on the day Corky is going to high school for the first time.
So help me if you embarrass me.
I'm not gonna embarrass you.
You know why? Because I will die first, that's why. And
why are you dying this time, Becca? Becca says I'm gonna embarrass her. I'm not.
Dad, my whole freshman career is up in smoke. Poof. There it goes. With wings on it. Down the toilet.
Yeah, you wanna put a plug in it?
Flying south.
Do you ever think your brother's got a little sweat in his palms about this? Maybe you've given a little more support and a little less lip.
Life Goes On seems to build on the goodwill developed by Benny on L.A. Law and Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man. It also echoes the realistic family atmosphere of the movie Parenthood. Chris Burke, who plays Corky, is only one element of this show, but since he's a young actor who actually has Down syndrome, he's clearly the most inspirational. The whole cast is great, though. And Life Goes On is the best family drama in a very long time. Whether it'll last a very long time, well, that's for viewers to decide. Give it a chance.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Orjiva Blytus, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgin directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time on Fresh Air, is the world getting hotter? We ask climatologist Stephen Schneider how the greenhouse effect might change the planet over the next century. Also, rock historian Ed Ward examines Sly Stone's other role in rock as a producer. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.